This is Stephen Heller, September 23rd, 1995. Alchemy, Act of Transformation.
Context within which it fits, to which we were alluding last time, are probably in need of reiteration and a bit of refreshing. So let me very quickly mention some of these. Taking a little different approach from the one we have taken last night. Throughout the entire known and possibly even the unknown history of the human race, there have always been sort of two main approaches to the psyche and to the life of the spirit by way of that. And one of these is a very slow, a very gradual, and on the whole a very unconscious approach, where the psyche is just sort of simply allowed to undergo its own growth-directed changes in its own way without any particular stimuli put into its repertoire. So there is an imperceptibly slow growth-oriented change that goes on, and it's really to this this kind of a procedure that the great mass religious movements, popular religious movements, the mainstream religious movements generally devoted themselves to. We have to recognize that there are some very basic needs of the human psyche, which have always been present. And they are very largely in the nature of being reassured concerning some kind of an underlying meaning or order in life and in the universe, which then might be duplicated by way of a meaning and order within the individual. The recognition that things are working in some kind of an orderly way does not come easily and naturally to the human mind. It has to be reassured in that regard. Life on this earth has always been difficult, has always been hazardous, and filled with various anxiety-producing and disorienting circumstances. We have to really, I think, fairly seriously combat the notion that before there was any technology or before there was this or that, things were wonderful and okay in the world. You know what? As far as we are able to discern, things were never wonderful, things were never okay, things were inevitably rotten on an ongoing basis. It's not that they have become rotten. They were just that way. The rottenness changes. The nastiness takes on a different face at various times, in one historical period we are suffering from this condition, in other historical period from another one, but things have always been difficult. People were in need of some sort of a reassurance that in spite of these existing difficulties, there is still some kind of an order, some kind of a plan, some kind of a meaning to life on earth. And it is to this that the great mainstream religious movements have addressed themselves to. Now, today, I think this morning around 5 o'clock or so was the autumnal equinox, which brings to our mind that the cosmic calendar, with the two equinoxes and the two solstices signaling the coming of the four seasons, has been probably one of the earliest systems by which people were reassured of this kind of an underlying and repeating order, the cycle of the eternal return. so that by contemplating the change of the seasons, return of the seasons every year, or on the shorter basis, the apparent movement of the sun, people could point to an implicit order in the universe and in life. And this gave them always a certain reassurance that the sun will rise in the morning, that the sun will come back with full force after the darkness of winter, and so forth. And in this manner, being reassured concerning a certain underlying order, they were able to conduct their lives without really being eaten up by the terrors of life. But in addition to that, there was always an other orientation. There were people for whom this kind of reassurance in itself was not enough. But people who discerned within themselves and within their fellow humans a potential for radical change for the better. And this is the potential that to which the name transformation has been given. And that this transformation, moreover, is not only a matter of slow, orderly, evolutionary growth, but that it is a matter of sudden and momentous change. So a minority of people, so it would seem, from the beginning of human history, has devoted itself to the study and the understanding, and then based on that, the informed practice of this kind of a radical change. And this was generally carried on by smaller groups existing either in conjunction with or sometimes developing parallel, in a parallel manner to the great popular spiritual structures as mysteries, as they were called in the ancient Mediterranean world, schools of yoga, groups of shamans in different historical periods. These were the people who addressed themselves to the development of this radical transformational possibility. And in most cultures and in most historical periods, they were generally able to carry on these activities without too much interference from others. If you look at the ancient Mediterranean world, which after all is really the cradle of Western civilization and its offshoots, you will find that there were state religions, big popular religions of the Greeks, of the Romans, of the Egyptians, of the Babylonians, and so forth. And then allied with these were the mysteries. In these, which incidentally shouldn't be called mystery schools, because they were not primarily places of instruction, but they were rather place, you might say, laboratories of personal transformation, of radical change. To these people were admitted for whom the more low-level popular religions were not enough, and who wanted something else, who really wanted to change in terms of the development of a greater spiritual potential. In some cases, these mysteries were extremely influential and very numerous. If you take a look, for instance, at the history of the Eleusinian mysteries in Greece, in ancient Greece, you will find that as many as 2,000 people or more were initiated into the mystery every year. very large number of people. And interestingly enough, with that many people being initiated, not a single one ever talked about it and ever betrayed what they have really experienced. Now, if you ever have been in contact with Greeks, maybe there are some Greeks here, you know, to somehow induce a Greek not to talk is a major, major accomplishment. It's really a miracle. So how they did it, it's really difficult to tell. I think a fairly informed guess, however, that the reason was not only that they swore an oath not to talk, but the reason was that what they experienced was of such a nature that it wouldn't do any good to talk about it. That it literally couldn't be described. And so that ensured the secrecy. In any event, these were very influential places of personal transformation. They probably, some of them certainly did descend from very, very ancient kind of really pre-civilizational, maybe early shamanistic origins, and then became more and more sophisticated. However, in a certain historical development, difficulties arose concerning this. And these difficulties arose very largely when the monotheistic Semitic religiosity coming from ancient Judaism and some associated groups began to amalgamate with the other Mediterranean cultures and eventually brought forth Christianity. After about the first 300 years or so of Christian history, the spiritual structure of Western culture came to be reduced to a uniform and a unitary pattern. And these the existence of mysteries was no longer possible. See, the monotheistic model has certain dangers. And one of these is that everything is envisioned as being unitary and one way. There is one way of doing things, and anything that deviates from that is the equivalent of idolatry. There is one God, one law, one way of doing things, and therefore anything else is initially suspect and eventually has to be done away with as invalid. And so the spiritual traditions came to be reduced to a popular folk religiosity. And that is really what happened to Christianity after about the 4th century thereabouts. Now, how is this great spiritual need of a certain number of people in the culture in the direction of personal transformation to be satisfied? It became a great difficulty and a great problem. And if you look at the history of the Christian religion or of Western culture for that matter, almost in every century there were at least one and sometimes two or three kind of major outbreaks, upwellings of this mystery tradition, but they were inevitably suppressed. And even the coming of the Protestant Reformation didn't really make any great difference, because now there were just a few other sets of repressive orthodoxy added to the one that already existed, and they were not substantially better in that respect at all. So quite early in this development, there came about a very fortunate technique, and that was the well, how should we put it? The transvaluation, good old existentialist term, you know, the transvaluation, the metamorph and metamorphosis of the mystery tradition into a discipline within which it could survive and function at least for a considerable period of time. And that discipline was alchemy. The fact that this is what actually occurred in itself was kept very quiet and very private. And while some scholars in modern times began to suspect that that is what might have happened, it wasn't really conclusively demonstrated and proven to have been the case until our good friend and teacher Carl Gustav Jung came on the scene, as I mentioned last night, who discovered that alchemy was the living bridge that connected this mystery tradition, largely associated with Gnostic, Hermetic, Neoplatonic schools in the first, second, and third, the early fourth century, the living bridge that connected that mystery tradition with actually later historical periods, right up to the modern age, right past even the period of the French Revolution, into the age of the Enlightenment, after which time the scientific developments and so forth came to obscure alchemy. As I mentioned last night, Jung even pinpointed one particular individual who was the key figure in making that transvaluation, in the figure of an Alexandrian Gnostic alchemist named Zosimos of Panopolis, about whom Jung wrote various things, including this famous essay, The Dream of Zosimos, and so forth. So, we have a strange phenomenon before us, because in order to successfully carry out that disguise, a discipline had to be found that was in appearance as radically different from the mysteries as they existed as possible. The mysteries were all oriented toward the spiritual process. There may have been drama and ritual in them, but the focus was on the internal experience of the individual, and this was well known, that people would experience something mysteriously powerful within themselves. They were confronted with an interior vision of the archetypal psyche, let us say in Jungian terms, and afforded not only an opportunity to perceive it in a visionary manner, but to unite with it, vision and union. Yeah? And now along came another discipline which was ostensibly of a completely external character. It had to do with physical things. People would take vessels. Into these vessels they would put mineral and chemical substances, and then they would heat up that vessel, and they had formulae for mixing these substances with each other, and then the substances would undergo changes in the retort and became something that they were not to begin with. So apparently a quite an extroverted kind of proto-scientific procedure. Yet, so Jung has discovered, there was a secret side to this. And the secret side had to do with the fact that this external medium of activity was utilized as a symbolic projective modality of internal transformation. That by doing these operations externally in a laboratory, in what used to be called the alchemist's kitchen, the alchemist would become so intensely engaged in what he was doing that what he was engaged in seemingly externally would simultaneously occur to the alchemist internally. So that the external operation became a symbol of internal change. And that what went on in the retort in the laboratory outside would occur within the psyche of the individual alchemist inside. So alchemy, while it had a very physical, a very external method, this method by repercussion, symbolically symbolize what was taking place within the alchemist inside. As I indicated last night, this sort of physical reification, physical verification of the internal changes was also something that became very precious to Jung for a variety of reasons, but one of them being that it sort of lifted the psychological process of transformation out of a relatively abstract kind of never-never land of psychological concepts and gave them a very definite a physical symbolic dimension, which is generally very helpful to the human psyche whenever it is able to avail itself of that. Now, you need to keep in mind, however, that especially in certain historical periods, such as in the Renaissance period and so forth, alchemy became very popular. And there were a considerable number of alchemists everywhere. And obviously, not all of these alchemists came to be transformed into highly individuated, great, enlightened spiritual beings. In fact, some of them were real tricksters and crooks and remained that way. The fact that some people undoubtedly practiced this art, because that is what it was called. It was never called a science, it was called an art. In fact, it was called the art, or the great art, Ars Magna. That while there were practitioners of the art who practiced the art in a lowly and unspiritual fashion, there was always a core of alchemists who understood this deeper spiritual meaning and who utilized it in that fashion. And the famous quotation that Jung always used, which I also used last night, being from Gerhardus Dorn, from one of the famous alchemists who stated, admonishing his fellow alchemist, "Therefore be you living philosopher's stones." So that the individual alchemist himself would become transformed in this fashion. Now, this is the context within which we need to understand the alchemical discipline. As to the content, I said a certain amount about that last night. The content of the method of alchemy And this, I cannot reiterate this often enough. I don't care if I repeat it ad infinitum and indeed ad nauseam, because it is so important and because it is so difficult to really, in a truly practical manner, to internalize and appreciate this, that the method of alchemy in terms of transformation is a very radical one. And that it has nothing in common with the commonly accepted notions of a linear growth, just a linear growth and extension of consciousness. That naturally most of us would like to be more than we are. If we don't, I think there's something wrong with us. Then we have sort of given up. Maybe it's time to become, to use the politically correct term for death, just become biologically deprived, you know? you know, maybe it's time to go, and if you go along with reincarnation, to have another go at it, so to say, and start over again. If you don't want to be more than you are, if you don't desire more understanding, more light of consciousness, better abilities to come forth with that potential that is inside of you, then there's something radically wrong. But most of us envision that change as just becoming more of what we already are. We might not like very much a good many things about us, the way we are, but that's all we've got. And so we want to have just more of that. And that, incidentally, that desire for moreness is something that projects itself symbolically into all sorts of things that we do externally. I think that the innate drive of the psyche for greatness, for moreness, is ultimately the wellspring and the fountain origin of greed. Because physical greed for things, is an external, an extroverted symbolic manifestation of having more of the psychic wealth. The early Gnostics even often defined the ineffable greatness of the great powers and energies of the spirit as the treasury of light. And so when we can't get the great internal treasury of light, we try to set up an external treasury and accumulate things. I have as you probably know by now, I have a kind of a perverse memory and imagination, and I remember peculiar things that illustrate things to me. And one of them is a scene in the old movie Key Largo of dear old Edward G. Robinson. He's marooned there with his companions in the Florida Keys, and the hurricane is coming, and so forth, and his lady friend is there with whom he's arguing all the time. And one time, one of the things that he says to her, "I know what you want. You want more. You want more." You know? And it's something that could be said to every human being. They all want more. But what we really want is the internal more. Now, how is this internal more going to come? It is not going to come by accumulating more external worldly goods. But when we have sort of abandoned that, then we use other things. We want more of, emotional experiences, more excitement. Anything from churches to nightclubs and to MTV. You know? That's the emotional more. Then we maybe we get a little bit away from that. A lot of emotional excitement, becomes tiring. That's why I never could really get all that excited about these generally false notions about the old Romans and Greeks and things, that they would have these endlessly ongoing orgies, you know. I said, you know, the fatigue factor must put an end to that. It's not going to work. You just get worn out. You just get tired. You have to take that into account. And there's psychic fatigue as much as physical fatigue. So we get to something maybe a little bit less fatiguing, and those are the treasures of the intellect. So we want to learn things. We want a lot of information. And now we don't even have to go to the libraries. We don't even have to go to books. We can get it out of the little computer. You know, that's where the information superhighway. So we will become more by having more information. But be careful. You know, the great danger now is that you could become a roadkill on the information superhighway. You know. And one of the main factors there is that the accession, not accessing. I detest that term. You gain access to something. You don't access something. This is computerized corruption of the language, you know. But the gaining access to more and more information will still leave us unsatisfied, because it is not information that the psyche really wants. Physical things are a substitute, emotional experiences are a substitute, information is a substitute. But a substitute for what? We don't know what. We can go to the Gurujis and the Swamijis and the Yogi Bears and everybody else, and they will tell us in lengthy and eloquent terms, even at much greater length than I am going on right now, you know, and with a sonorous Indian accent or something of that sort, you know, of what we want. But it doesn't really mean anything. Why? Because the only way you find out what you really want is to get it, to be there, to have it happen. Then you know, aha, this is what I really wanted. It only comes to the individual on the basis of experience. But the great difficulty, I got this wonderful Transylvanian liquid, I really should... I think I have to pierce it with my teeth to have it a little, to access it, huh? In a minute. What the alchemists recognized early on was that there is an almost overwhelming difficulty, which consists in the tendency of the psyche to deal with the new experience almost exclusively, or indeed exclusively, in terms of past experience. And that therefore the psyche cannot get out of this kind of treadmill of going around in the circle while seeking for more, and somehow never really breaking out of the physical, emotional, and rational, intellectual modalities, which were the ones that have proven to be unsatisfactory to begin with, but it cannot break out of them. So a tremendous psychic frustration exists in most psyches because of that. So something has to be done to undo that. And the way that the alchemists went about this symbolically, they indicated in an outline form last night by showing that the physical substances which they desire to transform in the alchemical retort have to be subjected to a complete radical change until they are no longer what they were to begin with. And that is how, you know, I put that diagram up last night, which comes from the statement of one of the alchemists: of a man and woman make a circle, of the circle make a square, of the square a triangle, and then a circle again, and thou wilt have the philosopher's stone. And very quickly going through it again, the initial circle and the square are transformational stages that occur to us to a large extent without any, at this point at least in the development of humanity, without any great personal effort on the part of the individual, because the original circle is the what Erich Neumann called the uroboric consciousness, coming from the Ouroboros, the tail swallower, in the form of, you know, a serpent or dragon who holds his own tail in his mouth. And Erich Neumann, on the basis of Jung's teachings, postulated that's the kind of consciousness that we have very, very early in our personal history, probably when we are in our mother's womb, and as very little babies, there is no unfoldment, there is no differentiation. When the dragon lets go of his tail and begins to unfurl and start moving, that is the beginning of differentiation, the movement of consciousness. And prior to that time, there is a sort of a self-contained, a sort of primitive wholeness that consciousness has. Then it begins to move, ego development takes place, and eventually there is the square, we have our ego, it has four corners, and earth, water, fire, and air, which Jung psychologically has identified as the functions of sensation and feeling and thinking and intuition. And that's the functioning structure, like a house, like a castle within which we live. It serves that purpose, and that purpose is very valuable. But, the alchemist says, this is where the real alchemical change, transformation has to take place now, because that house has to be shattered. What we have been has to be broken up. And they regarded this in a very radical manner. It's not enough just to talk about it. It's not enough just to plaster and paint the house and make it look different or something of that sort. It has really got to go. And the deeper spiritual traditions the world over are fairly agreed on that. This is where we have the great difficulty that we run into. We Jungians, you know, I mean, we have to identify ourselves as something. So with the Buddhists, for instance, and various other people, but primarily with the Buddhists, because the Buddhists generally insist that the ego has got to go. We say on a psychological basis, well, if the ego goes, then we haven't got anything. In fact, the chances are that we become psychotic or something of that sort. As far as I can see, except very occasionally, the Buddhists and the Jungians are still sort of talking two languages in that respect. It's I would sort of predict that it's one of the great challenges of depth psychology in the future as to how to deal with that difficulty of the value of the ego on the one hand and the limitations of the ego on the other hand. A largely Western problem. The alchemical paradigm, therefore, is very, very radical in that respect. And it says that somehow this structure that we have built, and it, for good purposes, no doubt, and which is our own cosmos, our own natural world, has to go under, and something new has to emerge. So there, in the alchemical retort, there are all kinds of chemicals, all kinds of substances that are being brought to bear on the elements that are there to break them down. and everything breaks down. Initially, it looked very nice, looked very orderly. There were all these various things, usually in different colors, these minerals and powders and so forth in the retort. Now these other substances and the heat underneath the retort are being brought to bear upon them, and they begin to break down, and they don't look like anything anymore. You know, the fermentation and subsequently the distillation of alcohol, fermentation of substances which produces alcohol, were also very important to the alchemists. If you ever try to, I think around here in Oregon people do it quite often, make wine, then you will see how that works. I never made wine in the regular way, but when I was a kid, as a sort of a miniature alchemist, I would take grapes and crush them and put them in some kind of a vessel and then watch them change. Make a terrible smell eventually. But my mother wasn't terribly happy about it, but I was able to keep it away from her. And so there's a beautiful, clear grape juice. You know, it looks just great and it tastes great and everything else. But you wait and it becomes cloudy. It begins to look and smell like it didn't do at all before. And a horrible-looking kind of ugly foam rises to the surface. You didn't realize that there could be so many impurities in this thing. Where does it all come from? Of course, it's all due to various to fermentation bacteria and so forth. And so for quite a while, what is happening to this substance is that it comes to look and smell and taste a lot worse than it has been before. It becomes an ugly, miserable sort of thing. And if you then become discouraged and take it and throw it away, well, then of course you don't have anything. But if you wait, like the alchemist is supposed to, it'll clear up, and you can take that that scum off the top, and eventually you have wine. There may be good AA members here and things like that. We talked about AA a little bit last night and all that, and they're probably going to get annoyed. But you've got to realize that what is the one other word for alcohol, old word, spirit. Mm-hmm. So a spirit has risen in this substance that wasn't there before. And that is a work of alchemy. So there is a nice little image of the transformation process there. But initially it had to change into something completely unrecognizable. It had to be broken down. And from that process, that breakdown process, then begin to arise the creative agencies which eventually produce the real result of alchemy. What is the essence of creativity? Creativity means a potential to produce something new, something that hasn't been there before. Nothing short of that is creative. The academic world is a kind of counterfeit of creativity. When you write a doctor's dissertation or even a master's thesis or so forth, the official definition is that you have to make an original contribution to human knowledge. So you put something together that nobody else has done before. But what you do in actuality, you take about 100 books, maybe, or a little less or a little more, and out of these 100 books, you make one. You know, that's about all it is. So it's not really creative because nothing really new has come forth. But what is the ultimate exercise of creativity? Is to recreate ourselves, to create a new being within ourselves, of ourselves, that is essentially and substantially different from the one that was before, and not only different, but better. <It's> if you live a while and you know a lot of people, you see a lot of people change, and often you sit and you know, but hardly any of them changed into anything better. there are, of course, a variety of reasons for that. But something new that is better. And better in the psycho-spiritual sense, in the depth psychological sense, is what? More conscious than it has been before. A radical expansion, a radical change, a radical intensification of consciousness, which does not come about, of course, unaided. Now, this we really talk now about the first fundamental principle, which means that our world within which we live, the world has to be radically reduced. When it is thus reduced, now comes the next important development. And this is almost as difficult to face and to accept as the first. Because now comes the method of alchemical transformation, which exceeds to the breakdown of the old reality. And what is that? That the change occurs as the result of an interaction, more often than not a conflictual interaction of two creative principles which arise in the alchemical retort, or in our case in the psyche, once the tyranny of the ego has been broken. Now, a little analogy, not completely good one, because it's of course like all human things in the collective very very flawed. You can see in the world today or at any other time, whenever you had a dictatorship, whenever you had a tyranny in some place, in some country, and this tyranny comes to an end, as for instance the tyranny of the Soviets in Russia and in all the various satellite countries. What is going on in most of these countries now? All kinds of conflict. Look at what is going on in parts of the old Yugoslavia and Bosnia and so forth. Conflict. Because when the let's say Stalin and Tito and people like that were the square, the old ego, and that square is like the iron curtain on all sides, you know, the barbed wire, the minefields, the guard towers, the dogs, and so forth. This is the tyranny of the ego. This is the Gnostic demiurge, Yaldabaoth, holding everything in his claws, the watchers of the world. When that breaks down, what happens? Internal conflicts arise. And these conflicts can produce several things. Ultimately, at times, if things go well, in an alchemical sense, they can become creative. And something new and great can arise out of them. But much of the time, because there is no wise alchemist there to somehow facilitate the process, the conflict just remains a conflict and becomes ever more destructive of itself. And nothing new really arises. Every revolution, every civil war and things like that had a good many idealists in its leadership and its ranks. He said, we'll do this, and then the new thing, the new society, the new world will come around. Utopia, and it will be wonderful, a philosopher's stone. Did it ever happen? Not very much. A little bit of it here and there. It's the history of humanity is very largely the history of an alchemy that hasn't really worked yet. The transformations kept going, but only up to a certain point, and then something always goes wrong. Just another aspect of the frustrating character of life, you know, and of the futilitarian principle, which I mentioned last night. So after the meeting, if you are thus inclined, I will take applications for the International Futilitarian League, which will have been founded on the day of the vernal equinox in Seattle, Washington, in this particular year of disgrace. there we can sort of happily be together and meditate upon the futility of all things, and thereby sort of gradually grow happy, because nothing is going to work out anyway, so why worry about it? I think it's a good principle. The first thing to accept is that the old self has got to go under. The second thing to accept is that the new self can be worked upon only by way of the arising of conflictual, at least in part conflictual, binaries within ourselves. Not again a straight development. It's not a matter that now we are going to behave well, we are going to pray and meditate well, we are going to do all of these things well, and we are going to become better and better. But rather we have to become conscious of the dualities within ourselves, the binaries, the oppositional situations that exist within ourselves, and allow them to interact with each other, but consciously, by being there and watching them in ourselves. We all have psychological conflicts within us all the time. If anyone in this room claims that he or she doesn't have any, then he just doesn't understand the situation. That's all, you know, we have them. But for the most part, we are... They go on within us unconsciously, and also in interpersonal relations. You know, maybe you have a husband or a wife or its equivalent, and you think you're getting along famously and everything else. Then some little thing happens. He or she didn't put the slippers away the right manner, or brushed the cat in a way that bothers you. You know, and all fury erupts out of you. How can you do that? You know, you always do this sort of thing. And there's all of that conflict is out in the open because you haven't been aware of it before. You thought everything went very nicely. This is a very trite kind of an example, but we are unconscious of the conflicts that go on within us. We are unconscious of the binaries. The alchemist does is he becomes aware of these and lets them work, but in a supervised and insightful fashion. By the way, when are we supposed to have the first break? Do you know? It's when I want to, huh? Yeah, hold a half an hour. Okay, good. Yeah. Sure, fine, good. All right, I just don't, you know, I look at those chairs and they look kind of hard to me. Would you like to maybe stretch a little bit at this point, but just, you know, just maybe without very radical behavior? yeah. Don't become too creative. Mini break that we had, so I will also try to elaborate those on a little, and then we'll also have to have some questions. But I want to go through this now. A little more quickly, let me also indicate to you what we are going to do. We have our technical difficulty has been overcome, and we'll be able to do the projecting of the images of the Rosarium after the late break, and then I will show you the various major breakdowns in the phases of alchemy and how they relate to those 10 pictures. I think that will give you a great deal of detailed information. But So now we are at the principle that these binaries, these dualities, even conflictual dualities, which they are at certain points in their activity and their movement, arise within the psyche, and that the creative result comes from these. So that the extremely important thing for the alchemist in a psychological sense is to be able to endure the pressure, the forces of that interaction. This is probably one of several, I'm sure there is not only one explanation for any of these things, one of the several explanations for the repeated statements of great teachers like Jesus, of Jesus both in the New Testament and in the Gnostic Gospels, I have come to bring not peace but a sword. You see? In other words, a creative conflict will have to occur in the transformational process itself. And this is not going to be just peaceful. It's not going to be just nice. But rather, it is going to be very stressful, pressureful, difficult, and there always will exist the chance, the possibility of things going wrong and there being a failure. The alchemical experiments at the practical level were, and in those places where they still practice them, were frequently interrupted or brought to an end by accidents. There were explosions, there were fires, alchemists were injured, they died, their laboratories burned down, all kinds of things like that. Those were the practical results. Even in comparatively modern times, I did not know this gentleman anymore, but I knew some of his friends. I'm reluctant to own up to it because they were very brilliant people, but people of a very strange reputation. There was a gentleman who was one of the early leading rocket scientists at what became the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. His name will come to me. I knew some of his friends. In any event, this was in the 40s, and I think His name was Parsons, Jack Parsons. He has a crater on the moon named after him. So a very, very famous man. The man was also a magician and an alchemist, which he didn't really own up to, I think, very much at JPL. but he was. And he died in an alchemical experiment. The general belief is that he blew himself up with rocket fuel. You know, maybe he was trying to propel himself without a rocket. his friends assured me that it was really much more in the nature of an alchemical experiment. I think this was in the very early 50s or in the very late 40s. So quite recent. So these things go on. Now, what does that mean at the psychological level is that transformation has its hazards. Problems can arise, things can go wrong. There is no guarantee of success. Only unconsciousness has a guarantee that it will remain that way. And everything will be peaceful and basically stupid, and then things will just go on that way. You know, unconsciousness is a very peaceful process in a way, but of course it also has its very, very radical difficulties. but consciousness doesn't, and so there are difficulties. Now I don't want to go off on this particular tangent, but Maybe those of you who are sort of a little more daring researchers in Jungian matters might want to look into sort of the early history of the analytical psychological movement. And you will come across there, it was even called by a different name at that time, back in the 20s and early 30s, of the role that the techniques of active imagination played in the work of Jung and of various people there. It's not talked about a great deal. And who knows, a punitive posse from Zurich might descend upon us with Swiss helicopters. And I don't know, if I talk too much about it, they may come and bombard us with cuckoo clocks something of that sort. A fate much worse than death, I'm sure, you know. Because this is sort of a... sort of a Jungian secret, but you know what happens? Secrets don't remain secrets very long nowadays, not since the Eleusinian mysteries came to an end. In any event, you know, let's put it this way, there were some very powerful and very effective techniques that were used by C.G. Jung and by some of his close associates in the early days, which, however, subsequently they came to soft pedal and to substitute other techniques for. And if we ask why, apparently because they found out that the alchemical hazards attendant upon these were quite considerable. So even in Jung's own practice, there were hazards that revealed themselves, and which at certain times then they had to get away from at least certain aspects of the techniques themselves. Well, they are very, very interesting. So this always has to be kept in mind, that these hazards are there. But a very unusual, again, sort of... a method that doesn't come naturally to the mind, that doesn't appeal to us, namely the transformation by the interaction of two opposing elements enters the picture. It's not something that we would naturally think of. It's not something that the pleasure principle is affinitized to. And it's scary, as the current term has it. And it's because of these various factors, both the destruction of the existing reality structure, let's say, to begin with, then the strange method of the interaction of these opposites, that earned alchemy the term in Latin, the opus contra naturam, the work against nature, because it's not the natural way. By natural here meaning the way things ordinarily tend to happen by themselves, but it's a sort of a turning around of everything in order to bring about that radical transformation. And so then we have now the interaction, as we mentioned before, of the salt and sulfur, the king and the queen, with each other. Now again, there is, as we will see in the pictures, there is, however, always a third factor, and that is the apex of the triangle. You need to remember that the alchemists were also, virtually without exception, quite religious people. They in all of the alchemical books, there is a great deal of emphasis being placed on prayer, purification of one's character, approaching the alchemical work in a very, very religious and very, very spiritual manner, constantly invoking the help of God and things of that sort. In no way is this to be envisioned as some kind of a secular process, and at certain points there were considerable convergences between certain aspects of Christianity and alchemy. Christian alchemy, of which the Aurora Consurgence is a very good example. You know, very, very prominent people in the medieval Christian church were alchemists. Saint Albertus Magnus, who is a teacher, one of the doctors of the church, Doctor Universalis. There are only about five or so saints to whom the title of a teacher of the church, doctor, has been given. He is one of them, a German archbishop. His disciple, Saint Thomas Aquinas. All of these people were alchemists. There were several popes who were practicing alchemists, one of them being Pope Sylvester II, who incidentally, to my great joy, was the pope who was instrumental in establishing Christianity in my native land of Hungary. So we had an alchemist pope as the patron of the country, which pleases me very much. All of us vampires were real happy about that. Now the reason I bring that up is because it is understood that it's not just these two interacting upon each other, but a third factor, which is at a higher level, a supernatural help, transcendentally originated help, transcendental facilitating is necessary in this process. Because when that is not there and active, then the interaction of the opposites doesn't really become creative on its own. The alchemist, the paradigm of the alchemists declared that in order to create the new, the creator has to be involved. And when that is left out of the picture, then things don't work right. And now, it was extremely difficult for Jung, and it is still very difficult for those who try to follow in his footpath, to somehow bring the emphasis on this element back in a psychological manner. Because we live in a secularized, materialistic kind of culture and society where even the alluding to other than mundane and mundanely human factors is shunned and abhorred to a very great extent. Yet Jung never made any bones about it. He said, you can call it whatever you want, you can call it God, you can call it the imago Dei inside the human, but there is something that is at a higher level, that is not on the ordinary level of human consciousness, and this power has to be addressed and it has to be involved in the transformation process, otherwise it will not work. We must acknowledge our dependence upon an agency that is greater than our consciousness as we know it. Unless we do that, there is no success in our operations. And so, if psychology is indeed to be more than a very temporary series of attempts to remedy pathological symptoms of the psyche, if psychology is really to address itself to the greater transformative events in the psyche, psychology must have, in the widest sense, some kind of a religious dimension. And I think this is an extremely important recognition of Jung, and if in any way we start to soft pedal that and try to get away from it, then we are really getting away from one of Jung's most important and most serious contributions. And it must also be recognized that this transcendental element, which is indicated in alchemy by Mercury, medium of the conjunction, the third factors is salt, sulfur, and mercury, is really superior to everything else. That it is really a sort of a mysterium tremendum, as Jung used the Latin term, a mystery before which one trembles. Awesome and great and transcendental, and certainly not made up by us. You know, be very careful about making up your gods, and I dare say goddesses. Because when you do that, you're faking. Those kinds of gods will not work. The Gnostic Gospel of Philip has a sort of sneering little statement about that. I think it goes like this. God created man, and man created God. It would be better for such gods to worship men, because now men bow down and worship their creations. It would be better for these gods to worship men. Which doesn't mean that there isn't a greater reality, but so you really have to work your way in terms of contact through to that greater reality, because if you create gods in your own image and likeness, they are not going to be able to substantially facilitate the transformation. They must be... they must have an autonomous existence. They must be not just contained in the psyche. You know, Jung distinguished, he spoke about this more openly toward the end of his life, he distinguished, for instance, between archetypes as such and archetypal images. The archetypal images are in the psyche, they are psyche. But they have a root in a reality that is, as he said, psychoid. It's like unto the psyche, but it is not in your psyche anymore. So the archetypes are not just these little beings that run around in the back of your head, you know, little products of your brain. But there is really something very, very numinous, very ultimate, very transcendental at the core of them. That's the kind of thing that we have to address. That is the facilitator. So that is kind of the presence of the Mercurius is the mystical aspect, really, of alchemy. That one has to know how to address this. And then by way of the helpful operations of that divine transcendental principle, the process of transformation takes place. And as I mentioned also last night, the transformation ultimately takes the place of a conjunction, a coming together, a fusion of the two opposite principles. The two eventually become one, as the result of the long process. And you will see when we look at the pictures that within that process there are all kinds of strange things. For instance, when the union first occurs and there is already a unitary being, this unitary being, for instance, is not viable yet and it dies. And it looks like everything is over. And the alchemist then has to go on and continue, and then you see the soul of that newly fused unitary being go up to heaven and stay there for a while, and then come back and reanimate the dead corpse again, which meanwhile has been washed again in the celestial waters in the dew of heaven, and then it is enlivened, and then the final result occurs. So there are all kinds of mysterious and dark things that happen. Many of them, time and again, it appears that if everything has come to an end, then you have to give up. And of course, Jung applied the alchemical principle to various things, but one of them also was from which is the book from whence these pictures are taken, in his book, The Psychology of the Transference, where he likened the analyst and the analysand to the two opposing forces, as they are, and that their consciousness has to conjoin in order to create the individuation, and that the analysis often appears dead. Looks like a dead corpse. It's not going anywhere any longer. Now, I do admit that perhaps there are times when the appearance is correct. Maybe it just is dead. There's always that possibility, you know. Maybe it's not symbolic. Maybe it's just the way it is. This is always a possibility in life. But more often than not, these dead points appear in any kind of a process, and then one has to bear that and outlast that and keep the heat up, and then the miracle happens. And it's pretty much toward the end of the transformation process, by the way. Then the final result is that it is a circle again. Really, this looks much more like, I don't know, well, I think it has the shape of a persimmon, but that is just my bad draftsmanship. It is supposed to be a circle, and this circle is then the philosopher's stone, the individuated human, the ultimate result of alchemy, which has all kinds of magical properties. And as we mentioned last night in connection with Chinese alchemy and so forth, one of these is immortality, the healing of physical ailments. All kinds of things can happen at that time because the potentialities of the psyche have been developed and have intensified to such a degree that the psyche truly becomes a miraculous being that is capable of all sorts of things. But these miracles that are produced by the Philosopher's Stone are not the essence of the Philosopher's Stone. They are merely the spin-off, the side products. What has occurred is a wholeness. Wholeness has been reestablished. The divided, split apart, and largely unconscious psyche has become whole, has become total, and that is a new being. Now, we should, just one more minute. I'm already responding to questions now because I've been asked a few before. I've been asked, for instance, as to how the alchemical mythos, let us say, relate to its predecessors in that sense, like the Gnostic mythos and so forth. And we said that it comes from there, that it has been changed into this. How do they relate? Well, like the old Gnostics, my friends, always said that we have all come from a wholeness. Our original home is a place of totality, the pleroma, the fullness of total consciousness. And we have come forth from that for some mysterious purposes. And we have gone away from that wholeness into a world of differentiation, into a world of creation. We have passed from the realm of being into the realm of things, which is where we are. And in that process, we not only lost our original condition, but we lost our consciousness of it. We have become alienated from the wholeness. We no longer remember who we are. We have even forgotten why we have come here. And we stumble around here in a state of amnesia, not remembering our true nature, not remembering the purpose of our existence, and really being being corrupted by our own projections that we perceive outside in the world. As I mentioned before, we become greedy for all kinds of external experiences because we can't remember the true experience that our essence really desires. Then we are being gradually awakened to our true estate. We have remembrances and glimmerings of something else, and then we begin to change and to transform in order to resemble our original condition that much more. And when we reassemble our divided, our corrupted nature here, and when it comes together into a state of union, then we are able once again to enter the circle of wholeness and to become an undivided being, an individuum. So the essence of the Gnostic mythos is an original wholeness, then a fall from that wholeness, an alienation, and then a recovery of that wholeness as the result of a process of transformation. Now, this, of course, was not accepted by the mainstream religions of either Judaism or Christianity. We might as well bring Judaism a little bit, after all, it's Rosh Hashanah, you know. And, Happy New Year, my dear, you know. And you know that song, no? From Cabaret, you know. And therefore it could not be exercised and mentioned openly for centuries, but it changed itself into this particular alchemical paradigm because this was safe. It attached itself to that, and they were. These people were regarded as scientists and as potentially very useful people because maybe they could make gold and things like that, and that was all right. But there is a definite internal compatibility with the ancient mythos that works to that effect. Now, what we will do, as I mentioned before, we will after the coming break now, we will be able to look at this process in detail, and we will see certain steps that were outlined, but so that we won't have to waste our time with those things before, I might as well mention now, because that's the fundamental structure, that there were originally four major phases of alchemy, of the process of transformation. Later on, in most places, these four were reduced to three. Jung didn't like that very much, but he couldn't do anything about it at that point anymore. You know, with Jung, all good things have to be four. in any event, they are usually described by the colors, the black, the white, the yellow, and the red. Later on, the yellow was sort of done away with, and there remained only the black, the white, and the red. And now, we might as well kind of reminding ourselves of what we did before. This is the beginning up here. We are already in that square when we go into the black phase. So originally we were the circle, then we became the square, and now the big transformation begins. So the black has to be, and which is also often called they are both Greek and Latin names for this. You know, the lefkosis is the Greek, nigredo is the Latin, blackening. And that blackening really means what we have spoken of before, is the consciousness, in our terms, the consciousness of the ego going under, gets down into the darkness. The paradoxical situation indicated earlier that for a while it's not that we become more conscious than we have before, but it seems as we are becoming less conscious. Because the light of the consciousness goes down into the darkness, and there it is washed by the primordial waters, and it is undergoing the kind of, as Shakespeare called it, sea change, you know, which the tempest was mentioned last night. You know, there it is, full. What is it? Full fathom five. Thy father lies in the tempest, where. The description is the father comes back, but it's given to the young prince. The spirits tell him on the island that his father has died, and that he's down in the waters, that he's gone down under the ocean, and his eyes are pearls, and there are corals in his face, and he's undergoing a sea change. But obviously it wasn't a death, because then the father land. So these are the alchemical symbols of the tempest that we were talking last. And so the sea change, down into the dark sea it goes, and it is the matter, the material substances in the retort are becoming what was called the prima materia. They are reduced to the prima materia, the first matter. What is prima materia? It was envisioned as sort of the original chaotic pre-creational substance of being. So we are going back to the chaos. People who are nowadays are talking a lot about chaos theory and all of that. This has a relationship of that, because it's out of that dark chaos that the creative things come. You know, one thing about the dark is that there is an infinite number of possibilities in the dark. If you are really in the pitch dark, you know, you can, you don't even need a very good imagination, but you can suspect that there could be all kinds of things there. That's why the darkness is so frightening, because there is no telling what there is there. But that, in turn, while frightening, is also creative. Any kind of visualization, any kind of these sort of magical processes, visionary processes and so forth, work much better in the dark. Because in the dark, your images stand out. You know? Magical evocations in ceremonial magic in the Middle Ages, and so were all done in dark chambers. And so people say, oh, black magic, you know, they got the walls lined with black and everything else, and there's no light. But the reason for it is because that is vision-inducing, that there you can really see things. Maybe you have had experiences like that too. When I was a small child, from maybe about the age of, I would say, 4 until the age of 7 or 7 and a half, before going to sleep, I would constantly see things in the room. Unstoppable imagery. I'm not going to go into details, because you might figure out too much about me. You know, I mean, there is only so much public disclosure that I'm going to do here. I had very laid-back parents that way. Nowadays, they would have run me to a psychiatrist and given me Prozac and heaven knows what else. But nothing like that. They didn't even give me any warm milk, because I hated milk. What they would do is they would leave a light on. And then I would still see the stuff, but much more faint, and then could go to sleep. But in the dark, you know, things come out. So that's why the darkness is the great symbol of the creative matrix out of which all things come, and that is really the blackening. What has been is obscured. You don't see the old world. You don't see the old self. Its preoccupations, its conditioning, its ideas, its expectations, its fears, all goes down into the dark. New things come up. And it goes on for quite a while. Then comes the white. This is symbolic of the rising light. Now a new light rises, and as it comes, the darkness is dispelled and things become irradiated with a white light. The incidentally, the at some point here toward the end of the white, there is a beautiful kind of subphase that has sometimes been referred to in Latin as the cauda pavonis, the tail of the peacock. When the white light now begins to differentiate into the colors of the spectrum, and it's like when the peacock opens up his tail with all those wonderful colors in it, now the retort begins to shimmer in all colors, and there is this wonderful display of, it sometimes also has been called the glory of Hermes, when the all the colors of the light come forth. But this entire phase has to really do with the return of the light in its various ways. That is the white phase. The light shineth in the darkness, says the Gospel of the poem of the Gospel of St. John, and the darkness knoweth it not. So there's a new light that comes out of the darkness, the creative light, the light that hasn't been there before. And now it comes out into the open. This is the aurora, the rise of the sun. Then about the yellow phase, which existed in the earlier alchemy, is really largely a sort of a transition to the red phase, which means now that the light changes and intensifies and heats up more and more, and from the white it goes to the yellow changes into the red as the new substance comes together. The stone of the philosophers then arises in the final, in the red stage, and it's sort of symbolic of red heat. And this is where the final product of alchemy then arises here. A darkening, a coming back to the light, and an intensification of the light until it just becomes the red phase, the final product, the essence of the psyche, the self with the capital S, the core.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.